The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes creating a professional website for your business, personal brand or portfolio so easy it's newsworthy. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello and welcome back to Science Weekly with me, Ian Sample. On this week's show...
I know this isn't television, but I'm holding it up to you.
It's not got a wedding ring for me, I don't think.
No, and there's something inside it.
Yeah, what is it?
It's the future.
Professor Keith Barnum discusses his new book, The Burning Answer, a user's guide to the solar revolution and his own cutting-edge research at Imperial College London. Also, we'll be discussing some of this week's science news, including fears that research on mutant flu viruses could unleash a lethal pandemic, the great bison returns to the wilds of Romania, and the significance of a small ancient engraving called the Madeline Mammoth. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Joining me to discuss this week's science news is Nicola Davis, commissioning editor of The Observer Tech Monthly, and Adam Vaughan, The Guardian's online environment editor. Welcome both.
Hello.
We'll kick off with you, Adam. Have you ever wondered what it sounds like when a bison is released into the wild in Romania? Yes, that's the sound of Romanians singing and celebrating the release of bison into the Tarku Mountains. Adam, you wrote about this. Tell us more.
So, very recently, in the middle of nowhere in Romania, even by rural Romanian standards, it was in the middle of nowhere, 17 bison were released into the wild, well, an acclimatization area to start with. This is one of the biggest reintroductions of the mammal in Europe ever. It's Europe's largest herbivore, and there were two things that I really enjoyed about this and interested me. One is the history of it, is we actually wiped them out in the wild in 1927. We hunted them, we logged the hell out of their habitats and so on and so forth. So a fairly sort of typical kind of humans versus wildlife story. But there were 54 left in captivity at that point. And what's fascinating is from those 54, they've managed to basically breed a population of thousands now, which there's about 5,000 odd globally, about 3,500 of those are in the wild. And so they think that although even though it's a very low genetic base, which is one of the concerns, they think from that they've now got a healthy enough sort of spread. But they want more, basically. And it's partly part of this sort of trend of like of wilder species coming back to Europe. And so, you know, it's sort of a piece with, you know, efforts to reintroduce the lynx and things like that, in which, you know, it's been calls for in Scotland, and beavers, which we have a couple of sites in Scotland but none in England and Wales, and which have, and wolves, which have been coming up back across the whole of the continent, and that now can be seen, you know, not far from major cities.
How long have they been working up to this, and what do they do? Do they just breed them in zoos or what?
So these ones I saw trotting off the trailer were... they were from zoos and reserves, so from, you know, sort of different versions of captivity, and they were driven in massive trailers across Europe, which took several days, and they were, you know, tranquilized, and they quite, you know, I wasn't there when they were rounding them up, but there's fantastic video of them, you know, tranquilized, because you don't want to get too close to these things, right? They can weigh as much, about up to one of the balls can weigh up to about 1,000 kilograms. So they trank them, they put them on a mat of sorts, and then they drag them onto the lorry.
And so this is happening in Romania. Is there are there plans to recreate this elsewhere in Europe?
So there's roughly, I'm going to probably get this wrong, but something like 8 or 9, 10 countries they're in the wild, and including Poland has one of the biggest populations, and they've actually got enough there now that in some parts of Poland you can get a hunting permit so they kill, a certain number can be sort of legally killed each year. I asked the Romanian minister, the Secretary of State for Biodiversity there, whether she thought they could get to the point where they would do the same, you know, there's enough there to do the same, and she said she, even if there were enough, she just thinks hunting's not cool, and she would be against it. So, but yeah, there's also some in Ukraine as well. I'm not sure how they're faring out there at the moment.
And what sort of impact will these bees have on the environment out there, in the ecosystem? Is there a concern that they might sort of tip balances and cause problems?
So this is one of the other interesting aspects of it, is they're sort of known as referred to sometimes by ecologists as a keystone or umbrella species. So there's a good parallel with wolves, for example, which one of our columnists, George Monbiot, has done a very good video, which I recommend you watch, of how wolves change rivers. And it's basically about how, in the case of wolves, they were introduced in Yellowstone in the 90s. They basically made deer change where they go because the deer were scared of them, obviously, because they're a predator. And as a result, there was less damage to trees and more vegetation grew up, stabilised the soil, there was less soil erosion, the actual path of the rivers changed. But in the case of the bison, they're going to create more open spaces, so they can eat about 30 odd kilograms of grass and herbs a day. So they can they'll create open spaces. They can break up the ground with their hooves because they're so heavy, which other animals wouldn't be able to do. They'll spread seed in their dung. They were one of the big herbivores that used to have, like the auroch in the wild in Europe, and we got rid of them basically.
So on the whole, positive.
Seemingly, yeah. I mean, we'll see, right? I mean, this was the strange thing. I really struggled to find anyone, even when people were very drunk in the evening, who didn't like it, which is very unusual. And there's a lot of farmers in Romania. Like, there's a lot of small farms, and no one really, I think because it was relatively remote, and they still have some wild areas in Romania. It's not that sort of issue where you have, like, in the UK, where people are landowners and stuff are rubbing up against that. There's not that sort of friction. That was the other thing. The people story is just. The people were from young, from guys in their 80s and caps, from another age to teenagers who were just, constant on their phones the whole time, broadcasting the whole thing. They were really, really excited about it. And Romania, it's not the wealthiest part of the EU, and it does need jobs other than farming. So they're hoping. It's really early doors, but they're hoping for some sort of ecotourism type stuff. And there's a couple of local blokes have already been trained up as rangers.
What do they really say, though, are the reasons for doing this? Are they looking at the environmental benefits? Is it some sort of historical issue that we just like to have them back, or what?
I think it's a bit of a mix. I think it's kind of a mixture of cultural, ecological, and kind of just sort of symbolism in terms of, one of the guys, the managing director of the Netherlands-based charity that was organising it, he told me that, it's a symbol of hope. We're so used to just seeing species decline, and conservationists issue a lot of reports, and like, to him it was like, here's some hope, here's something concrete they're actually doing. Here's 70 animals that are now in the wild. They're hoping eventually there'll be as many as 500 in that area.
So tell me what this actually looked like when you were there, because I must say I'm not, there may be people who are worse than me at recalling what a bison really looks like and what they might sound like and so on. I mean, give us a picture of it.
So I was a bit disappointed actually when the first ones finally came out, because they were relatively young ones, and I was expecting absolutely massive hulking beasts, of which some of the latter were actually. It's like, I mean, the young ones are like, just like the size of a cow. So I was a bit disappointed by that, because I've seen quite a few cows. But we were in the middle of nowhere, more or less. It was several miles down a muddy path from a village called Arminish. It's in the southern range of the Carpathian mountain range, which is obviously a huge area, but this particular bit is called the Tarki Mountains. It's heavily forested. It's not like a British forest at all. It's been left to run wild. There's fallen trees all over the place, and 250 odd people all gathered, a mixture of press, conservationists, and a lot of local people, young and old, as I say, to sort of basically celebrate. I mean, the bison took so long to come out of the lorries. They were having nightmare of these huge lorries down this tiny muddy path, and then some of the bison didn't want to come out. It was a bit and no one wanted to get too close to get them to come out. We'd all been told to be super silent and not say a word, because the animals would get freaked out, but by the end people were sort of whooping as they came out. So yeah,
why is it that you get reintroductions fairly commonly in Africa but not so often in Europe?
I think that's a really good question. I don't know the answer. I mean, that was kind of one of the things that Franz Schepper, who's the managing director of Rewilding Europe, was saying to me, he said that out loud, you know, he said, I've done this a lot in Africa. I'm completely speculating here, but I think it's partly just that Europe is very developed and there's not a lot of wild places left. So you do often end up with this sort of usual friction of, you know, farmers or landowners or people with some vested interests being opposed often. There are often sort of vested interests that are opposed. And you know, parts of Eastern Europe are some of the few remaining areas in Europe that are still wild.
To read Adam's article and see the video footage of the bison being released, just go to theguardian.com/environment. This week I wrote about a controversial topic, which is the creation of mutant viruses for research on sort of pandemic strains. And there was a research paper that came out saying that a couple of scientists were worried that this kind of research might trigger a pandemic. Instead of preventing one, it might actually cause a pandemic by these viruses escaping from the lab. And it's been a controversy that's been around for a couple of years now, since scientists really started publishing work on what are called gain-of-function studies, where you take something like bird flu and you mutate it to the point that it can travel quite easily between mammals. And the kind of animal you tend to use in these experiments are ferrets. So you can infect ferrets and then get the virus to mutate inside them to the point that it could be dangerous to mammals and presumably dangerous to us. Now, this study came out and saying, well, we think that the risk benefits don't really add up for this kind of research, that the scientists will say, if you don't do this work, you never know what sort of genes to look for in the wild. You don't know what sort of strains might be dangerous. But the researchers I was writing about from Harvard and Yale were saying, well, there's no clear evidence that actually the information you get from these studies can help you stop a pandemic, because you tend to see the dangerous strains too late. And that you can actually get a lot of the information about what might be a dangerous strain from other means. So it started off quite a discussion, with the funders on one side saying, well, actually, we think these studies are obviously worth doing and they're funding them. A lot of scientists around the world are doing them now. But others saying that it really doesn't take enough note of the potential downside of triggering, even though it might be a really low risk, the downside of triggering some sort of pandemic hasn't been taken into account properly.
So if the laboratories that mutate these viruses, if they accepted these recommendations and just stopped what they were doing, how would the people who work in that field look at how
I think these viruses
evolve and mutate?
So the article was written by Mark Lipsitch at Harvard University and Alison Galvani at Yale. And what they weren't actually calling for an end to these studies. They were just saying that they really want to see the funding bodies, which is like the National Institutes of Health in the US and bodies, other bodies around the world, want them to do independent risk assessments to say, okay, really, realistically, what will you get as a benefit out of this kind of research, and what are the risks of it? They're not, and then if those risk assessments add up, then fine, go ahead with it. But they are concerned that those risk assessments aren't being done properly, so and that they're not being made public. But they're also saying that they really want researchers to be doing this other suite of experiments, which would really use sort of strains that you pick up in people or you see in wild animals. So you could look at, for example, if you're worried about the coronavirus that's circulating in the Middle East, you would take those viruses from people and see how, say, a really bad infection compares with a more mild infection, seeing how the genetics there change, and try and understand something about the way the viruses mutate and so on in those conditions, rather than actually creating versions in the laboratory which are more dangerous than anything out in the wild already.
But I mean, the idea about being more dangerous than anything that's out in the wild already, I mean, researchers are already dealing with extremely dangerous pathogens in the lab all the time. And several scientists have come out and said, actually, we are already doing lots of these very high level security and safety procedures. I mean, you've got something like Ebola, you don't want that just being lost down the Tottenham Court Road. I mean, so it's not as though this is anything new. And, you know, have you found that researchers have found it possibly a tiny bit patronising to be told you've got to be careful?
Well, it's interesting, because I obviously went to all the scientists who are doing these studies, or at least two of the key ones, Ron Fouché in the Netherlands and Yoshiro Kawaoka at University of Wisconsin, Madison. And they both came back and said, look, first of all, they criticized the calculation that these Harvard-Yale group had done, looking at the, they came up with a figure for the risk of a virus escaping. And they said that if you had 10 high containment US labs doing this kind of research over 10 years, there would be a 20% chance of someone in one of those labs getting an infection. Now, that's different to that person walking out the door with that virus and spreading it around the world. But they said that this was the number they came up with. And that number itself was shot down or certainly criticized by the scientists I went to. There was another issue where, as you've said, Kawaoka in particular came back and said, we're doing a load of these other experiments as well. So, and they feel that to get the whole picture, you need to do these animal experiments and you need to mutate the viruses to the point that they become more dangerous than something that you've seen in the wild. To know for sure what will work, because as much as you can study viruses in the wild and you can do calculations and simulations and such like, you will not know exactly what sort of virus is going to be a problem until you see it in action.
Are there any examples of some of this work that's been done that's, you know, where it's sort of demonstrated a specific benefit out in the real world from something that they've learned?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, Fouché did some work back in 2011-12, which was the paper that took him a long time to get published because the US Biosecurity Panel said it was too dangerous to publish. They worried that the information would be a recipe for bioterrorists, if you like. Now, his work, when it eventually came out, identified 5 mutations that you could get in a bird flu virus that would make it go airborne, as they say, that would make it become probably a highly transmissible infection among humans, if the ferret studies are transferable to humans. Now, speaking to Jeremy Farrow at the Wellcome Trust, he said that information is being used in Vietnam in surveillance. But then if you go back to the Harvard group, they will say, if you actually look in history, and in recent history, most of the time, whenever a pandemic kicks off, the genetic information on the virus doesn't land in labs until it's too late. And so they don't think surveillance is up to scratch to actually use this information on the ground to actually make any difference. And they also argue that even if you get the genetics of a virus that goes wild in animals, that can infect animals, you're using so few animals in these studies that your statistics are really unreliable and that you can't actually say, well, just because these few genes have changed and made it do this in this animal, if you only look for those in the wild, there could be a load of other mutations that might be important in the wild. And even if you see those in the wild, they may not be the ones that actually do make it behave that way in humans. They say that there are too many questions around all of this. Now, what the answer is, I mean, I don't know, but it's one of those interesting debates where I don't think it's cranks on one side and serious scientists on the other. I mean, this is a debate going on at a decent level. You can see my story on that at theguardian.com/science. Nicola, you've got a piece by our colleague Robin McKee about the wonder of a piece of mammoth tooth found in France 150 years ago.
Yes, Robin's been writing about what's known as the Madeleine Mammoth, which is a small engraving on a piece of mammoth ivory that was found almost 150 years ago. It'll be 150 years in a few weeks. He's been writing about what this meant and the impact that this discovery had on our understanding of our ancestors. And a really interesting point about this was that before they discovered this fantastic piece of art, there was a lot of debate about whether humans were around at the same time as mammoths or whether mammoths had in fact died out years before we turned up on the scene. And what this showed was because it was a piece of art of a mammoth on a bit of mammoth, which was clearly done by a human, that basically settled the question. We were around at the same time as mammoths.
Where was this from? Where did they find this?
Okay, so the site where they found this piece of ivory was at, I'm going to mispronounce this now, Abri de la Madeleine in the Dordogne. And it's basically like a kind of prehistoric sort of shelter. And they dug around in there. And the person that found it was a guy called Edouard Lartet, who was being backed by a British philanthropist, no less, called Henry Christie. And this was an extremely exciting time because, it really sort of pinned down what was going on. And there had been a lot of controversy about this because previously they'd found sort of tools and human remains all mixed up with sort of these other sort of enormous animals. But they hadn't really known whether that was a result of just rivers carrying the bones off and them all ending up in the same place. And there was no real way to know for sure who was around and when and what was happening. But what's interesting is that this piece of art, I mean, if you actually see the engraving, it looks extremely scrappy and scratchy and doesn't look like a nice mammoth at all. But what people have done is they've managed to sort of trace out and look at certain lines, and they've managed to find this wonderful picture of a mammoth. And what they say is quite interesting is that this isn't just a sort of static kind of Stubbsian portrait of a mammoth in full profile. This is a mammoth on the move. It's kind of got its head down and its tusk forward, and it looks like it's rampaging forwards. So one theory is that it was created to warn other members of the tribe that mammoths were dangerous creatures.
Although I think it's the equivalent of a traffic sign of a deer on.
Yeah, yeah, although if you've ever seen a mammoth, I suspect you might get the gist that they aren't exactly cuddly teddy bears, but there you go.
You don't need a warning sign.
Exactly.
So when was it done? When's it date to?
So it looks like it was about 14,000 years ago, though it's a bit difficult for them to pin it down much more than that.
So when they found this 150 years ago, did that settle the debate? Was it, I mean, it seems pretty unequivocal kind
basically,
of evidence.
Like, yeah, there seemed to be no other way that you could have, you know, they say because it's not just it's not like a cartoon, it's quite a sophisticated drawing, in fact. It's not just like a doodle. And so in a way, they say that because, you know, the proportions are right and it's quite a detailed drawing, that you'd have to have seen one to do it. Like, you can just dream
it
up.
It wouldn't have been that they'd seen the bones of a...
No, yeah. I think that the thinking is that it really is so good that it had to been done
but it did,
for mine.
Did it settle the debate in scientific circles over...
It seems to have done.
Okay.
A huge thanks to Nicola Davis and Adam Bourne. You can read all of those stories at theguardian.com/science. Professor Keith Barnum is a solar physicist and one of the UK's leading researchers in solar energy. He has just published his new book on the science and politics of this form of energy generation, titled The Burning Answer, A User's Guide to the Solar Revolution. Adam Bourne met up with Keith and started by asking about the key developments in solar energy.
Well, the key thing is the efficiency. And that means how much electric power you get out compared to the power you've got in the sun. And the panels that people are increasingly seeing on rooftops are about 14% efficient, something like that. There's a very interesting second generation that you're talking about, which are the thin film cells. Either less silicon or completely different semiconductors. They tend to be a bit less efficient, but supposedly they were originally intended to be cheaper, but they're extremely thin and they don't use much material, which is a very important point, of course, if you're starting if you're worried about expanding too fast and using too much material. So they're maybe 12-13%, something like that. But
yeah.
Then it comes the plastic solar cells, which are getting up to their efficiency is getting up to about 10%, something like that, and very obviously cost is extremely important. Their problem is basically how long they last. That's the big problem with them. They've got to work in the field. Also, bear in mind, they've really got to be competitive on efficiency because the cost of cells has come down so much that it's the cost nowadays of putting them up and the scaffolding and so on that's the big cost. Mm. Cells themselves are no longer the fortunately the limiting point. Then the third generation that we're working on, the efficiency of those we've achieved. Have got 42.5% efficient in manufacturing. Our research efficiencies are higher than that, but
14 to 42.
Yeah. 14 to 42,
yeah.
A factor of three. That's the point. But they're more expensive. I would say is that the applications we're looking at, like rooftop fuels, for example, a powering your electric car, or in windows, cutting your air conditioning requirements. The calculation of what you mean by cost and what you mean by how much more expensive is completely different. It's not just undercutting the cost of electricity because you have all these other benefits in these cases that you have to factor
in. It's not just the upfront cost. So it's your point. Yeah, it's the lifetime. In terms of everything else you say.
It's what we call multifunctional. Yeah. If it's doing something, if you're taking the hot water from it, for example, cooling water, hot water to take carbon dioxide out of the air, then how you've got to quantify what the benefit that benefit is. You're getting some side benefits.
Can you talk a bit? You've obviously been very close over the years to the actual sort of R&D of different solar technologies. Can you talk a little bit about what some of them are? Because obviously beyond silicon, there's lots of other materials being used for solar panels now. I mean, can you talk a little bit about what are some of the most promising in terms of cost and how efficient they are?
There's a lot of different technologies around, very exciting ones, plastic solar cells, for example, but they're cheap, low efficiency. But you've given me a great opportunity to talk about our cell that we developed at Imperial College. I know this isn't television, but I'm holding it up to you to show, Adam, at the moment. And it is extremely small.
Keith's holding up what looks like a little ring box of plastic.
Yeah.
A little see-through plastic box that could... It's not got a wedding ring for me, I don't think.
No, and there's something inside it.
Yeah, what is it?
it's the future.
It's a little black three millimeter by three millimeter black square, but I can't say
exactly.
What it is.
Thank you, Adam. Yeah. That is the quantum well solar cell technology we've been working at on in Imperial College. That reaches three times the efficiency of the current panels on current rooftops. The same area that you cover. From the same area, you could get three times the electrical power out of it. That's what it means.
So that means for the sort of household that are fitting solar PV, current sort of solar PV, where at the moment people talk about sort of 50% of your electricity use, you're talking about all your electricity use and you're exporting some back maybe.
Afraid not.
No, not quite.
Not quite like that. It means three times the power when the sun shines. So you'll have a lot of excess that you'll be pumping to the grid.
More.
But we do that by... having a plastic lens about the size of this box, 2 or 3 centimetres across, that focuses on the cell. And at Imperial, what we've done to modify this cell is to add a nanostructure, a quantum well, in fact 50 of them, within the solar cell, which is just the same as the nanostructure quantum well in the chip which made your mobile phone work. So... the reason we did it for our cells is to make it possible to optimize the cell's performance in desert or on a UK rooftop, because sunlight's very different in the two cases.
Yeah.
And that the adding those
why
quantum
we get
worlds
concentrated solar a lot
in the
desert,
in the tropics,
for example.
Thanks to our quantum worlds, you can also optimize these cells for UK rooftops.
The one thing I was surprised that there was less of, that there wasn't more of in your book was the sort of, you talk a lot about sort of the applications in the developed world. You know, you talk a lot about Germany, obviously, understandably. But I was surprised you didn't talk more about sort of potential for solar in, you know, poorer countries and where people are not even on the grid already, and about, you know, because there's a lot of sort of hype about people leapfrogging straight to technology like solar. And there's obviously some case studies of where people are actually doing that. I mean, Could you just talk a little bit about the potential for solar in the developing world?
You're absolutely right. In the developing world, and of course, there's an awful lot of sunlight.
Mm.
I do actually make the proposal that what the best thing we could do is give them the technology in terms of their own manufacturing plants to manufacture the cells, not get a profit from selling our own cells, but let them do it themselves. One of the ideas that I think would be very helpful for the developed world is if those factories were solar powered, and then producing other solar powered factories and disseminate the thing even faster. I mean, PV can disseminate fast, but if you produce more solar powered manufacturing plants, the whole thing really could take off. But
so
you're absolutely right. No, it's perfect for them. And the great advantage of it is that here's power that doesn't need a grid to be laid.
Do you think it's realistic? I was looking at there was a there's an international sort of renewable body called ARENA, and they had some statistics out recently on and saying of 6 million people or thereabouts are employed in renewable energy across the whole world, and a huge chunk of that was solar. I think it was about 2 million or thereabouts, and of that, almost all of it was in China. Like, you know, in terms, of it was. I mean, can those, you know, can you know, places, countries in Africa and Southern America and elsewhere, can they really compete with, you know, that sort of lead that China's got in terms of technology and, you know, head start, just simple head start? I mean, doesn't China just sort of own solar manufacturing?
That's a concern, but I do address this in the book because in the heyday of nuclear, governments were, for political reasons, going around offering nuclear power stations willy-nilly to whoever actually wanted the potential to produce a bomb. Crazy, absolutely crazy. I argue that solar could be the new nuclear in a positive sense, in that why don't we do as we did with nuclear? Why don't we export? We give those to the developing world and let them make their own.
Thanks very much, Keith.
Okay, thank you.
The Burning Answer, A User's Guide to the Solar Revolution, is published by Orion Books and out in all good online and offline bookshops. That's all we have for you today. Remember, for breaking science news night and day, just go to theguardian.com/science. But from me, Ian Sample, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, thanks for listening. Bye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today. No credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.